KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley.
We are from Hayward.
We're from the Inner Sunset.
I live in the Inner Sunset.
I live in Sausalito.
Coming up, a nonprofit in the Mission helps low-income families by digging into real estate.
Anybody who was earning less than $75,000 was rapidly getting pushed out of the neighborhood.
Then, this weekend is the Bay Area Book Festival. We'll meet the woman who walked away from her day job to start it.
I'm so appreciative of the many writers who put themselves out there very bravely.
And we'll go back in time to when radio first got its start.
It's just beeps in the air. That's all that it is, but it has a great emotional impact.
Connecting through the airwaves. Stay tuned, Cross Currents is coming up. San Francisco's Mission District was once a neighborhood known for being home to working-class immigrants. Now it's become a hipster haven thanks to the tech boom. As gentrification continues to push out longtime residents, some groups are wondering if there's any way to slow down these changes or even stop them. A local nonprofit is trying to do something: disrupt displacement through investing in real estate. KALW's Lisa Wang reports.
There's a special housewarming happening in the Mission Castro. Seniors and people with disabilities are celebrating their newly remodeled 42-unit apartment. I'm in a small room on the ground floor of the building. There's a buffet in the center of the room, and the residents are all over it, like college kids around free pizza. They're piling their plates with pasta, meats, and veggies. I meet Ernestine Moore, who moved to the building in 2004. She says the place was a dump.
But when I first moved in, I had a big hole in my ceiling for several years, and that caused mold and everything, and my nose got all infected.
It's hard to imagine living in these conditions, but Ernestine and the other residents stayed here for a reason. It's affordable. And things have changed big time for Ernestine after the remodel.
There's a button if I get into trouble that I can push, and help comes. And I have a stove that is automatically shuts off by itself in case I forget. It's an electric stove.
So how'd she get that sweet stove? Caroline Fang was one of the key folks who made it happen. Caroline heads up the real estate team at a nonprofit called META. META stands for Mission Economic Development Agency. And Ernestine's building is one of many in META's growing real estate portfolio. Now, you might think that a nonprofit group supporting low-income people is the opposite of real estate magnates. But Caroline sees it differently. She thinks if you don't own property, you might get priced out. Take it back to a few months after she started with META, back in 2014.
Housing was really the key piece. Anybody who was earning less than $75,000 was rapidly getting pushed out of the neighborhood, and the rents that had increased in the neighborhood were making it so that anybody earning less than $75,000 would never make it back into the neighborhood.
It was a big problem. So she came up with a big goal.
By 2020, we have to build 2,000 homes to essentially bring back the families.
But how would a nonprofit with no history of real estate development suddenly get 2,000 homes? Well, it helps if your new hire has over a decade of experience with real estate. And that's Caroline.
For me, it's not about how many housing units in terms of physical built space can I build. It's more about how many homes can I build, because those homes represent the starting point for people's lives as they then go out of that home base, if you will, into their work lives, into their play lives, into their schools, etc.
But 2,000 homes in 6 years? That's ambitious. So they made a strategy, and it's got two parts. The first is with the federal government. It's called Rental Assistance Demonstration, or RAD. Under RAD, San Francisco allows META to rehab housing that are at risk of becoming unlivable. Remember the remodeled building where Ernestine got the cool new stove? That's a RAD property. The second is San Francisco's small size program. That's where nonprofits buy small buildings with 5 to 25 units, off the private market using loans from the city. Small sites in the Mission cost around $3 million. Large ones can cost upwards of $60 million. So Caroline says Meta works with the city to help pay the bills.
Most of our funding for starting up our projects originally starts from the City of San Francisco Mayor's Office of Housing and Community Development. That then tends to be the what we call the permanent financing, too.
And there's more. Mortgages from private banks and other finance institutions, state financing, and tax credits help, too. Through RAD and small sites programs, Meta acquired 1,000 units by the end of 2017. Now they're going for 1,000 more by 2020, and they're on track to hit their goal. But what happens after 2020? Will they try and get more housing?
I think the intent is to actually reach a steady state. If we have been able to reverse displacement and gentrification.
And it happens one property at a time. Back at the celebration of the newly remodeled apartment building, a ribbon-cutting ceremony is about to take place outside. You know, with the big cheesy scissors. Caroline grabs them, and the countdown begins. But Caroline will tell you herself, it's not about her. It's about the people, like Ernestine, who Meta is getting these buildings for.
I have a little balcony, and I can look out as far as Dolores Park and where the tennis courts are. And it's beautiful, especially at night with all the lights. And I see the planes coming into land. I just have a great time.
That's all anybody wants, really. A comfy place to enjoy your life. In San Francisco, I'm Lisa Wayne for Cross Currents.
Lisa Wang is a fellow in this year's Audio Academy, our radio training program here at KLW. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This weekend, downtown Berkeley will transform into a literary paradise for the Bay Area Book Festival. Sherilyn Parsons started the event in 2015 after being inspired by the LA Times Book Festival. With no funding and no experience producing large-scale events, she walked away from her job in development to start the festival. Today, it draws about 25,000 people and hundreds of authors annually. This year marks the fifth anniversary of the Bay Area Book Festival. Sherilyn spoke with KLW's Janae Darden about how books changed her life.
Books, literature just saved my life. I mean, I grew up and not in a, you know, I was a refugee way, but I was living in the West San Fernando Valley where there was no culture. My parents were apolitical. There was really not a lot to do. And so I escaped into the library. I gave myself an education by reading, and they just opened vistas. And all I wanted to do from when I was 5 years old was to be a writer and be part of the book world.
Wow. And you kind of created your own book world.
I created my own book world. I mean, yeah, I grew up in a evangelical Christian environment. So there were a lot of rules placed on me. And I got married within that world when I was 21. Crazy. And yeah, then I went to graduate school at USC. And I started to think for myself and to question. And I ultimately left the marriage and began reading widely, I'd always traveled, but I went to New York for a summer and lived there and just started reading. And I came across Audre Lorde, and she absolutely shattered the white middle class self-absorbed, just sort of unaware world that I grew up in, and that's the power of literature and the power of writers like that. And, you know, I've written about it a bit, and I've said, you know, that it's not Audre Lorde's job or anyone's job to sort of enlighten, you know, a young white girl from the valley, God forbid, you know, but that's what happened to me. And I'm so appreciative of the many writers who put themselves out there very bravely and change the world, sort of one heart and mind at a time.
So you took a huge leap of faith to start this huge festival.
Yes.
You quit your job.
Yes.
Which shows your love of books.
Yeah.
Were you afraid, or were you just like, I'm just going to step out on faith and do this? A little bit of both.
A little bit of both, you know. I was working at the Center for Investigative Reporting, and so I knew the journalism industry. I'd worked in journalism mostly on the side of raising money and developing new journalism initiatives. And so I knew a little bit about sort of developing a project from scratch, and I sort of knew about raising money. I knew about it in the journalism field, and I thought, mistakenly, that it wouldn't be as difficult to raise money in the literary field. And what I discovered was that it indeed is. Literature and literary arts are kind of the poor stepchild of the arts in philanthropy, and the arts, of course, receive less funding in philanthropy in general, you know, compared to other activities. So I thought I was going to raise money pretty quickly. I did not. That was a rude awakening and leaving my job. So I actually went through some of my own savings in a year. I did some consulting work, but just in spreading the idea. So what I did for a year or two, I had no partners, no money, I didn't know the publishing industry. I knew books, but I just had this vision, and that's basically all I had. So I went around sharing it with everyone who would listen, and particularly people in the literary community in the Bay Area. So I just kept going and gradually brought other people on, and that's when it began to really take off. I got sponsors, not financial sponsors, but places like The Chronicle, media sponsors, KQED got involved, KALW, you know, was involved. And that's how it gradually took shape. You know, there is this love and passion for books. And a lot of what I do now is really literary curation. I mean, the festival has a very strong curated program, and very consciously curated. We've always focused on social justice issues. I mean, I've been an activist for years, and that's been important. Bay Area audiences are extremely smart, and I didn't want to just throw a bunch of authors out there. I really wanted to think about who we were bringing and what they would deliver to the audiences here. And, you know, people here just don't care as much about celebrity memoirs. So, and I don't either. yeah.
So, what can I expect, Cheryl?
What can you expect?
Yes.
Okay. Well, Saturday night keynote. I hope you're going to be around still for Saturday night. We have Robert Reich and Anand Giridharadas, which is a name I had to learn how to pronounce. And he was a New York Times writer for a long time. And he's written a book called Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. It's a talk about economic justice, and that's Saturday night, which we're pretty excited about. We're going to explore this new format where the writers talk with each other.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, and we're podcasting them, so that'll be fun. One of our donors, actually a woman named Lise Quintana, who runs a small press, Zoetic Press, down in the South Bay, she had this idea of bringing together two writers who were fans of each other's work and hearing the conversation that would happen between them. So we have, for instance, Essie Adujan. She wrote Washington Black, a phenomenal book.
Okay.
It goes from Barbados to Canada to the Arctic. It's like magic realism,
diaspora,
the story of this slave. It's phenomenal. So she's in conversation with Tayari Jones, who wrote American Marriage, which is just riveting. So they're going to be talking together. We have Joyce Carol Oates talking with Andre Alexis, who's a Wyndham Campbell Prize winner, who wrote this really trippy, speculative book that is, we paired him with Joyce because Joyce is a fan of his and vice versa. But Joyce's new book is also speculative fiction, which is fabulous.
So when this is all over, when the festival is done, when everybody goes home,
yeah,
all the authors, you know, travel back to where they came from, what do you read next to relax after all of this? Or will you, do you even want to look at a book after this?
Oh, I always look at books. Are you kidding? I mean, I've got this massive pile always. And people say, you know, that question about what do you have on your nightstand? I'm like, which pile?
Right.
You know, it's a lot of piles. After the festival this year, there's a mystery writer that we're bringing this year, and I'm interviewing him. It's a guy named Elliot Pattison, and he wrote a series of mysteries set in Tibet. And he's also won human rights awards to do with Tibet. And I've traveled to Tibet. I'm writing a book myself that's set partly in Tibet. So he has 10 mysteries in this series, and I haven't been able to read them all. But the ones I've read are just fabulous. And so I'm going to read the rest.
Okay, so you're going to curl up with a
mystery. I'm going to curl up with a mystery. Yeah, yeah, it'll be fun.
That was the founder and executive director of the Bay Area Book Festival, Sherilyn Parsons, speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. You can check out the festival this weekend in downtown Berkeley. Find the details at KELW.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now for an audiograph, the project that maps the signature sounds of the Bay Area. In the late 1800s, when Marconi figured out that tall antennas could use radio waves to carry sounds over long distances, he had business in mind. But sending voices across the ocean simply wasn't possible yet, so users sent messages using Morse code. Not only was Morse code efficient to send, it was a kind of international language. Anyone who knew the Morse alphabet could use a standardized set of signals to talk with anyone else who knew that same set of signals, no matter what.
Ta'azogli! Ta'azogli!
Help! Help me, help!
Hilfe! Ich brauche Hilfe!
It was like a reverse Tower of Babel. For nearly 100 years, Morse code was the official language of international communication for ships in distress. Then, at the end of the 20th century, it officially went silent on the world's oceans, replaced by more modern technologies. This was the last message sent.
What? Hath? God? What hath God wrought?
On that day, July 12th, 1999, the Morse operators who tapped out these signals for years, even decades, gathered to say goodbye.
Those of us who were there found it to be a very emotional scene. Some very tough-looking old buzzards, radio pioneers, had tears in their eyes.
Morse code is mostly gone, but it's not forgotten. If you head down an unmarked, tree-lined lane in far West Marin, just beyond a field punctuated with antennas, you might start to hear the sounds of the past bubbling up into the present. In this story from our archives, KALW's Julie Kane brings us the marine radio station KPH, a lonely spot in the Point Reyes National Seashore where dots and dashes make the hearts of tough old buzzards go pitter-pat.
It's getting close to 00 hours Greenwich Mean Time. 00:01 Greenwich Mean Time, we will begin our ceremonial broadcast.
A crowd of really excited people is gathered around Richard Dillman. He's the chief operator of the Maritime Radio Historical Society, and he's getting ready to send out a Morse code message to ships, ham radio operators, and other normally defunct marine radio stations like KPH, all of whom have turned on their old sets and tuned in for this special broadcast.
People around the world will be listening to us. They've been waiting for this all year. Tubes warming up, earphones going on, coffee getting hot, ready to hear these transmissions.
What we're waiting to hear is called the Night of Nights. It's an annual ceremony commemorating the very last commercial radio message sent in Morse code.
This station was originally founded in San Francisco at the Palace Hotel. Now, what does KPH stand for? The initials PH are the Palace Hotel. I'm Jack C. Martini. Like the drink, M-A-R-T-I-N-I. Just like the drink.
Jack Martini is 75 years old. He was the last manager of KPH, and he started working here in 1961. He stayed until the very end. He was the one who closed the door and turned out the lights when the station went dark. But before we get to that, back in 1905, the station was set up as a way for merchants and ship owners to communicate with ships out at sea, and as a way for wealthy cruise ship passengers to check on their stocks and investments back home.
Do nothing until I return.
Yes, even then, the drive for constant connectedness was very strong. The station was destroyed in the 1906 earthquake and fire, and eventually relocated to this remote corner of Point Reyes in 1946, after stops in San Francisco, Daly City, and Tomales Bay. And except for a few years during World War II, KPH stayed on the air. It was a money-making business. Sending messages cost 50 cents a word, which even now isn't cheap.
It was alive. There was so much going on all of the time. It was a hum of a place, and you walk in here, it was humming. People were doing it, moving around, copying code, yelling and screaming, you know, all that type of stuff, which made it more than just a job. It was a way of life, is exactly what it was for us. Absolutely loved it. This is KPH San Francisco Radio. And that's what I just said. It was like a death in the family when they closed it. And, well, it's still here, though, isn't it?
It sure is. We're in a room filled with buttons and switches, dials and consoles. People are happily tapping away on gadgets called bugs and keys. Morse code is in danger of dying out. There are only a handful of people who are still truly fluent. Dave Wolf is one of them.
And Dave, will you be willing to do your simultaneous translation as you have in the past?
Yeah, if I can get there.
All right. Well, Dave is an ace commercial operator from our sister station WCC on Cape Cod, also a shipboard radio operator. So the genuine article right here.
All eyes are on a big clock. Wolf and Dillman will start their transmission at precisely 5:01 p.m., the moment back in 1999 when Morse code use officially ended on the world's oceans.
Okay, we're coming up to the time.
Calling all stations from KPH, KFS, and KSM. Warm greetings to all listeners ashore and afloat. Stop.
Dillman and his crew will be sending and receiving messages until midnight. And some of the time, they'll just be listening.
The signal that we were hearing is on the most hallowed, may I say, sacred frequency of all time. It's the frequency that the Titanic used to call for distress. It's the frequency on which every SOS was sent from that day forward. 500 kilocycles, just below the AM broadcast band.
It's after the Titanic, they wanted people to hear lifeboats, which are always weak. 10 watts. So they set up these two periods an hour.
That time is called the silent period, and during it, nobody says a word. They don't want to miss any calls for help. Before I leave, I asked Dave Wolf one more question.
Can you do K-A-L-W?
That's it. FM. Cross current sounds like this.
At KPH, this is Julie Kane. For Cross Currents.
Thanks, Julie. You can hear more audiographs at kalw.org. And make sure you're subscribed to the Cross Currents podcast. Listen to all our stories whenever you want, wherever you want. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. This music is by San Francisco's Telegraph String Quartet. They're performing at the Bankhead Theater in Livermore this Saturday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Janae Darden, Kristen McCandless, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Porfirio Rangel, and Eli Wirtschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins, Tariq Foda, and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Shireen Adil. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.